So what we would like is for you to tell us your story. There are no restraints. We want to hear everything. We want to hear how you got in there.
You mean to the university?
Your story about your military service.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I was like, which...
which story? So, first of all, I would like you to state your name, rank, and service, branch of service.
Okay, my name is Michael Somino. And let's see, the branch of service was U.S. Navy. And I was a E4. I was a third class petty officer.
Can you tell me about your life leading up to your enlistment?
Born in Eugene, grew up in Eugene, and grew up in Alvador, which is a small community outside of Eugene. Learned how to drive a tractor before I drove a car. Let's see, my father was an immigrant to this country from Mexico, so probably some of my experiences probably were impacted by having brown skin in a predominantly white community. And other times, I think the era that I grew up in was pretty typical, I guess, of working class families. My father was an auto mechanic, and my mother cleaned houses for a living, so it wasn't a family where college was a big priority. People thought it might be a good idea, but no one really understood how to get to college. I graduated from Willamette High School in 1982. And at the time, Oregon was experiencing a double-digit unemployment. There were no jobs. The timber industry was collapsing, so a lot of the jobs that my friends and I probably would have typically worked out of high school, our parents were not working in those jobs. So we used to joke back then that you either left the state and took your chances, or you joined the military. Or you died. There weren't a lot of choices. Some people just immediately went to college, but that wasn't really something that I was going to be doing, partially because I didn't understand how to get into college. And so I joined the military.
And do you want to tell us about your experience then from day one of the military?
When I turned 18 in March, I went to a recruiter, did all the kind of testing and whatnot, and said all my tearful goodbyes and went up to Portland, and from there I was going to be flying to Texas for basic training in the Air Force, and up in Portland. A urinalysis came back and they said, you were partying too much in anticipation for going to the military, and we see that you were smoking marijuana, and so get the hell out of here. So I got thrown out of the Air Force before I got inducted into the Air Force. So on the bus ride back to Eugene, which was going to be interesting to say hello to everybody that I just said goodbye to. I was still thinking about joining the military and kind of weighing my options. Okay, the Marine Corps just really didn't seem to match my personality. The Army just seemed to remind me of all the camping and hunting that I had done growing up and didn't really think I'd look good in green. So I decided, I'll join the Navy. So downtown is where the recruiting offices used to be, and it wasn't part of that slick multi-million-dollar PR industry that they have today. So I walked into the recruiting office, and it was dingy and dank and disgusting, and had water damage in the ceiling tiles. And here was this chief petty officer that was overweight and wore his uniform in a pretty slack way. And I just walked in and said, you know, you don't need to sell me on anything because I'm ready to sign up. And here's what just happened to me. And so, of course, I mean, back then, I guess the standards were slightly lower, you know, kind of just breathe on this mirror, and if it fogs up, then we'll take you. And so I went in. I had to go up to Portland and stand before an officer and swear that I was going to reform my ways. And so I went into the military under a big drug waiver, which is kind of funny because at the end of the day, I ended up being illegal, worked illegal in the military, throwing people out who got caught on urinalysis. So it's kind of a big circle thing. So, I did all that kind of reverse process, went back to Portland a few months later, and from there flew to San Diego, and just that classic, I don't know, get there in the middle of the night, and they load you onto a bus, and they start screaming at you, and then all the sleep deprivation and all the classic stuff that happens to you when you're... but I will say, just because I think it's so outrageous, that I joined the Navy, and it never once crossed my mind that I could be put on a ship. Not once. Didn't cross my mind. Which, to me, looking back on it, the Navy is kind of all about ships and ocean and whatnot. So, at the end of basic training, they marched most of us over to another part of the base where we... So, I don't know, basic training might have been, I really can't remember anymore, maybe around 11 or 12 weeks, and then we went to another part of the base for another 5 weeks or something of advanced seamanship training, where they had a not one-to-one scale, but it was pretty close. Big, huge wooden ship, just a model of a ship, on ground. We called it the USS Neversail, where we pretended to be on a ship and learn all the nuances of how to function on a ship. And still, at that point, it did not cross my mind that I could possibly be put on a ship, up until the moment that I received my orders, and it said, you're to report to USS Morningstar, homeported in Norfolk, Virginia. And I kind of thought two things. One was, where's Norfolk, Virginia? And the other thing I thought was, wait a minute, that's a ship. I'm going to be on a ship. So, yeah, that's how that all... started.
So you got to Norfolk in December of 83.
Yeah, so I went home on went home for Christmas, mm-hmm. and then just classic, just E1, no rank insignia, no nothing, with my big huge sea bag, landed in the airport in Norfolk. There was a information booth, I had two sailors in it. I walked up and I said, I'm here to report to my ship, or I'm here to report to my naval base or something. And they looked at me like I was a complete idiot, and they said, which naval base? Not realizing that not only was the world's largest naval base in Norfolk, but there were three major operating bases in that region. One was a naval air station, and one was home to what we would call gator freighters. They were the big troop carrier ships where the front of the ship would go down. And so I said I had no clue where I was supposed to go, of course, and so they just snatched up my orders and said, okay, we'll go stand over there, and some shuttle's going to take you to the base. And, I mean, that base at that time was the size of Eugene. I mean, over 100,000 sailors. You'd have to take transportation to go from one end of the base to the other because it was just so massive, and I was housed in the... what at the time was called the DNS piers, which is destroyers and submarines. So not only was I placed on a ship, but I was placed on a small destroyer. It was a frigate. So it was going to be completely haze gray, underway, harken back to wooden ships and sails and whatnot. It was, it was pretty intense. And they were just... I was part of the new crew that was coming on board. They had just come back from deployment. And so my earliest memories of the ship were standing at attention, and the captain was walking around pinning expeditionary medals on all these folks. They were quite salty and really didn't want to have anything to do with the newbies that were coming on board. And So, yeah, it was something.
So, for your entire time, you were on the same ship.
Once we, I guess I was fortunate in the sense that we were coming back, the ship was coming back from deployment, and then we were, so that was in December of 83. So we, I didn't go on my first deployment until 1985. So at that point, I was already a full member of the ship, because most of the hazing that would occur, at least in the fleet, would occur when you were out in the ocean. And so I was glad to kind of bypass
so from
those
December,
types of things.
December of 83 until your first deployment in 85, what happened?
I think at some point in there, we went in the shipyards, naval shipyards, maybe to modernize parts of the ship. That was on a ship that was built during Vietnam. Well, it was pretty crusty. So initially when I went to my ship, I was placed in a deck division, which kind of in the equivalent in maybe the Army and the Marines would be infantry. So it's just straight, as probably the only person in the history of the Navy to ever join the Navy and not think that he could be put on a ship, all of a sudden I was in deck division, and it's a lot of chipping and scraping and painting, and so I learned all of the nuances of all of the colors of grayscale, which is what the Navy's really into, and then they might put you on this rickety wooden device with a rope tied around your waist, and they're hanging you over the side of the ship so you can paint on the big numbers on the side of the ship, and just really funny things like that, or using a needle gun, which I had never touched before, to chip paint. And at that point, I'm in full-on panic mode because I had signed up to become a yeoman, which is working in an office typing, which was kind of related to why I didn't think I'd be put on a ship, because I thought I'd end up in some shore command somewhere working 9 to 5 and whatnot. And so the typical route of a yeoman would not be to go to San Diego. They would go to Orlando, Florida, and then directly from Orlando, Florida, they'd be sent to Mississippi. We're in the stars for me. Went through San Diego, went to seamanship school, went to the fleet, and then from the fleet, they said, okay, now there's finally a room for you at the school, so we're going to send you, pack your bags, and you're heading to Mississippi. And so I was one of only two people from the fleet that were showing up. They confiscated all of our civilian clothes from us and had us wearing uniforms again. And my first night in Mississippi, in Meridian, Mississippi, there was an orientation. And after the orientation, they kept me there, and they showed me a map of the city of Meridian. It's a pretty small town or whatever. And they just said, here are the places that you can go, and here are the places that are not safe for you to go because of racial stuff. So being from Eugene, I mean, I was just kind of odd. And so I was there for a couple months, and then really, truly, at that point, had no clue where I was going to go, but they sent me back to my ship, and there had been some really weird drug enforcement agency sting that had been going on my ship that I, of course, as an E-1, didn't have any knowledge of. So it ends up that my supervisor on the ship wasn't even in the Navy. He was a DEA agent, and they were doing all kinds of weird things with cocaine and busting people. And so here I show up back. Now I'm no longer in deck division. Now I'm in the part of the ship where it's administration people. And I have no supervisor because he's disappeared. The investigation's over. The yeoman in charge of legal stuff for our ship is in the process of being thrown out for doing drugs. So he doesn't even show up to work anymore. He just kind of lays around. And so there's an E3 who basically is in charge of me. And then although I had been on the ship, a lot of the people on the ship were kind of wondering whether I was some kind of weird agent or, you know, why I was on the ship. And then I disappeared for a few months and then I came back. So it was just kind of odd.
Tell us more about that.
Lots of layers.
Tell us
to
more about this DEA thing.
I didn't it was frightening because it was just this unknown, you know. And at first I didn't believe this story.
What was the story?
Well, that this person really wasn't in the Navy, and he had been on the ship for all this period of time, and then up and disappears. And so at this point we're in the shipyards, and at one point I'm guarding the parking lot in the middle of the night, nonsense. And so here's this nice car that drives up, and here's my supervisor wearing civilian clothes. And he's like, hey, you know, how's it going? And after I got off, we decided to get together and just, you know, party or whatever, and took me over to this other part of the base, officer's quarters, and that's where he was staying. And I think the worst thing about it was that I had this basically career E3, which means he was too damn stupid to advance in rank, who was over me, and he was from Tennessee, quite a cruel, ignorant type of person. And so he rode me really hard, and it was just the two of us, and I don't know. So I think all of those things kind of contributed to my impression of the military and my not wanting to really stick around. And then, I mean, just reporting to the ship, and you know, all of a sudden it's kind of dawning on me. I think when you're 18 and you're signing a contract, you know, when they said 4 years active duty, and I thought, well, high school was 4 years, that was nothing, you know. But yeah, now I'm thinking, well, this is 4 years, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in this structure, you know. It's where you sleep and where you work and where you eat, and everything is just confined to this small space.
I know I'm probably beating a dead horse, but the DEA thing.
So the problem was that when you're working when you're a yeoman, you're working in the ship's office, and within the ship's office, the expectation is that you're supposed to be working with classified materials, and you're working with officers' records, and so they don't care for an E3 and an E1 to be working with these records, and so the first thing they did was basically borrow, we ended up with an E6, wherever the hell he was from. So it was just a rotation of people that ended up in our office to try to keep things maintained. And, you know, there were a period of... I mean, it was kind of this era, I think, that started around 1978 with some horrific crash on an aircraft carrier and around drug consumption in the military. And so the military was trying really hard to tamp down on drug usage and just allowing alcoholism to just kind of run unabated. And I mean, I have lots of memories of going to, say, the enlisted men's club, and you had 17, 18 year olds just getting completely shit-faced, and, you know, it was just part of the whole play hard, work hard, work hard, play hard, you know, kind of thing. And so it was just kind of a lack of leadership going on. And you know, as eventually now I'm probably an E2, and you know, your worldview is very much as an E2. You're just kind of seeing the you know, you're not seeing any kind of big picture. It's just kind of the daily. I think you can sum up my entire enlistment as very Hawkeye, Pierce, MASH inspired. So I was always receiving really high ranks in my job, kind of my job knowledge and my job performance, but my military bearing was always really shitty. So I had a tendency to just kind of question things that maybe other people wouldn't have questioned. And so every day we'd muster and we'd be standing at attention, and they'd be telling us, here's what we're going to do during the day. And then every single day they'd ask, does anybody have any questions, comments, or concerns or issues? And then they'd point to me and say, not you. And I was like, you just stand there and shut up, and we'll get going. And it just turned into like a running joke. I mean, as I advanced in rank and was eventually sent off, we didn't have a legal person on the ship, so they sent me off to Newport, Rhode Island to go to the Naval Justice School. And so
how long did that course take?
Well, just classic military, you know. I think it was 2 weeks of 8 hours a day, 6 days a week, kind of intense training type of stuff. So
tell me about your deployments. You have 3 deployments.
Yeah, so come to find out that, so this is mid-80s. This is Reagan's big military buildup. This is Cold War and the evil Soviet Empire and all these things that now my students think are so damn funny to consider. So the ship that I was on, the type of ship I was on, are...
What kind of ship?
It was a frigate. It was a USS Moynihan. It's FF-1097. And our primary duty was ASW, anti-submarine warfare. I mean, that was just our huge obsession, was hunting for Soviet submarines. And we were very, very good at it. And so the type of ship I was on, if you were in the back part of our ship, and you'd look down, you know, and there'd be these doors that would open up, and then this device would spool out from the back of our ship. It's probably the size of like a small car, and it was a sonar device that would be underneath the water tracking for Soviet subs. And we had a helo that would be flying around dropping sonar buoys, and so I guess one ship on the east coast and one ship on the west coast had a more advanced experimental sonar or whatever, and so my ship was the one that had it, so that's why we deployed all the damn time. So now Mike Somino, who never thought he was going to be on a ship, is now mega haze gray and underway. And so, let's say in 1985, we...
What was the length?
Of the ship?
Of the deployments.
I think like 7 months, 3 months, and 7 months. So for, 85, 86, and 87. And then there were kind of other... we went to Guantanamo for whatever it was, 5 weeks of combat training, and... There were just these other, just always out and about, non-deployment moments in our lives. I don't know, sure. I think I went to the island of Bermuda about 8 times or something.
You're on a daily basis, since you were in the legal department, I guess, on the ship.
Well, that's the weird thing, too, is that the typical admin puke doesn't... Because I had started out in deck division, they had put me on a firefighting team. And so when I came back to the ship as a yeoman, deck division didn't see any reason why I wouldn't be part of a firefighting team. So in the entire Navy, you don't have yeomen who are firefighters. That was just something that was, I guess I was lucky. So they sent me to all these firefighting schools, Hilo Firefighting School and Deck Firefighting School, and so, you know, a typical day might see me in the office typing, but I'm wearing my firefighting gear because, you know, we're in the process of, every time our helo would fly, they would sound the alarm, and then all of us would go man our hoses and put our gear on. And so I just kind of live this weird life. As a legal yeoman, basically, because I was on such a small ship, the legal department was just me and an officer. And so on a ship, you know, your captain is judge, jury, and executioner. I mean, just hearkening back hundreds of years or whatever. So let's say we're out in the middle of the ocean and you're going to have captain's mass. Somebody assaulted someone or somebody got popped on a urinalysis test or someone missed ship's movement or, I mean, any number of things that the military gets mad at people about. And then usually it gets handled with the higher ranking enlisted, and if that doesn't happen, then it gets the executive officer, the second in command, and usually it's dealt with. And if that doesn't happen, when it rises all the way up to captain's mass, then, you know, it's gonna, so it might consist of, we're gonna have court. So it's just the captain, me, the master at arms, as the police of the ship, is going to be escorting the person in, and then the department people of that person's department. And so the captain might be joking with us, oh man, I'm feeling it today, oh, I'm going to chew that person out, you know, kind of thing. And then so you're just standing there like, all right, bring a person in, and the captain starts screaming at them, and then they start crying or whatever the hell they do, and then you kind of a common thing would be something like what they called 45 and 45, 250 for two. So 45 days extra duty, 45 days restriction to the ship, but $250 taken from their pay for 2 months. If you're in a deployment, you pull into port, the restriction days start ticking off. Maybe you're in port for 2 days, you go out to sea for 35 days, go back for 3 days, go out for 2 weeks. That 45 days now stretches, you know, as restriction to the ship for 6 months. Two times we sent people, so we're in Norfolk, we sent people, so back, I don't know what it is now, but the Marine Corps used to run the Navy brig. So we'd send somebody off to the brig for, what was it, three days? Some Geneva Convention thing. So we might send someone to the brig for like 3 days bread and water. So they're going to go to the brig, and there's all kinds of ways that the Marines are going to mess with them and give them bread and water, bring them back to the ship, feed them a meal, send them back to the brig for, you know, 3 days bread and water or whatever, and they come back, and their behavior is just straight up modified, you know, very compliant or whatever.
Seriously, is bread and water, they can...
They hand you a loaf of bread, pitcher of water. Wow. You know, during the day, you're going to sit in a chair in your cell. You know, you're going to roll up your mattress and sit at attention for 8 hours. Hand you a... I mean, you either sit there for 8 hours staring straight ahead, or they'd hand you, like, a Christian Bible and, you know, to bide your time or whatever. And then if you start falling asleep, then the people would come by and... help wake you up, or I mean, just the classic stuff.
Does the Navy, in the Army, the kind of trouble you got into was called an Article 15? Is that?
Yeah, so we'd have this for the UCMJ, yeah. Were using, you know, and okay. So like what it used to be, like Article 13 would, you know, just would be a page entry of whatever you did to you. Mm-hmm. I can't remember anymore if it was like a 121 or one. All the code, you know, sure. For like
only one I remember was
marijuana
15.
And all that, yeah. Kind of stuff. And then that would be, I mean, there were all the informal ways to modify people's behavior. So we had a lot of hazing on the ship, which ranged from, well, let's say it's your birthday. There's three things that are going to happen to you on your birthday. Either people are going to ignore your birthday, and you can be thankful for that, or whatever you are. You're going to get stripped naked and dragged somewhere publicly and dropped off. And that's kind of a way of saying, you're awesome. You're part of the in-group. Mm-hmm. That happened to me once. They take you to somewhere. Well, there was only really one place on the ship that you could. The anchor windlass room, which was a big void where the anchor chain was in the front part of the ship. And I'd take a rope and toss it over a beam and then tie up somebody's legs and hoist them upside down. And then people would stand around and just assault them, just beat their ass. And I saw that occur twice. So you get bored sailors. And
so I have a question. When you were in Norfolk, and you were on ship, was that where your barracks, for lack of a better term, was that where you lived?
Yeah, I mean, the pecking order in the Navy is you're either in the fleet or you're shore puke. Because shore pukes, their only existence is to serve the fleet. And then, of course, within the fleet, you got this massive pecking order. So you've got the tin can Navy, which I was in, and then you've got the silent Navy, the submariners, and then you've got the big, huge.
So even when
aircraft
you're in
carrier people, so you're in Norfolk,
shore,
and
you still lived on a ship.
Lived on the ship, all the time,
in
all
those
day, every day.
Itty bitty
racks, yeah. Well, they were all right. My best friend that I grew up with here in town, I talked his ass into going in the Navy with me, and he volunteered for subservice, and so we were stationed just by pure coincidence. We were stationed closer together than our houses were here in town, and on a submarine. Which when they deploy, they don't have enough racks to go around. So they hot rack. So you're sharing a rack with someone. You know, you're on duty, you're sleeping, you're, you know, and you're hoping you're hot racking with someone who's got good hygiene. And I'm, that's straight, that's the way it was. Yes. So in Port, in Norfolk, they slept in what kind of looked like a dorm. So it was like a building on base, and you'd be rooms, and there'd be like two or three people to a room, and pretty fancy compared to my life or whatever. You know, and I wasn't married. I mean, eventually the E6 in my office, who was very professional and very kind and all that, I mean, he was married, had a couple children, and so when we weren't on deployment, he was going home at night and then would come to work the next day or whatever. But
okay, so the married guys did
for
get
a
to...
single cheap, you know, I mean, I technically could have combined money just like college students, you know, we could have rented a place out in Norfolk, but if you're not in a month-to-month lease, you know, and you deploy, you're gonna lose out one way or the other. So
now on board ship when you're in deployment, are the upper enlisted people, do they have separate quarters, or at least better quarters?
E7 and above.
E7 and above.
The chiefs have the chief's quarter, and that's where they sleep, and they have the chief's mess. That's where they eat. Officers are up in officer country, and that's where they sleep, and they have the wardroom, and that's where they eat. E6 and below, we
all
eat on the mess decks. And
okay.
Well, E5, or maybe it was just E6. E6 is, I mean, you could be standing in the mess line for a long time. The line's not moving because all the E6s just go to the front of the line
mm-hmm.
and get served. And always that, just always, forever. In our compartments, the racks were stacked three high. So middle rack is the one that's most coveted because you don't have to bend down and climb up and all that stuff. So all the high-ranking enlisted would be in the middle racks, and then the rest of us would either be wherever which way. Because the bottom rack, you know, I mean, your bed, your mattress is basically sitting on top of your locker with all of your worldly possessions. And so everything is just very tight. And then when you get up in the morning, the bottom rack, which is what I preferred, you'd lift up your rack, it was on hinges, and you'd hook it onto the next rack above you so that the floor space is opened up for people to come in and sweep and stuff like that. So, big thing. Yeah, over the 1MC, the intercom system, at 6 o'clock in the morning, they would do reveille, and they would say heave out and trice up, so you get your ass out of bed and hook your rack up. And you know, and then in the Navy, just like every branch of service, I mean, it's been difficult for me to describe these things because I'm trying to, in my mind, translate Navy words into civilian words. Just, you know.
Oh,
so
you're doing great.
Okay.
I know.
So
you're actually explaining everything.
It's weird when you first join the Navy. It's like this foreign language thing, you know, where it's like port and starboard and aft and forward and, you know, line instead of rope and all this other deck instead of floor and overhead and all this weird stuff. And then, you know, by the time you are on a ship and then you deploy and all that, and you're like, okay, I guess it all starts making sense, and all the bells and all the whistles and all the stuff that, you know, British Navy this and that and whatever else traditions that we ended up having.
Is there anything that surprised you about the Navy, apart from obviously being on a ship?
Well, I mean, the hazing was horrible.
Really?
I mean, and there was more funny hazing, but it always kind of resulted in some degree of pain or whatever that I didn't really care for. I don't know. I guess I didn't have any kind of romanticized views when I joined the military. I figured it would be, you know, challenging and hard and all that kind of stuff. You know, some of the things... it's amazing to me out in the middle of the ocean, if it's overcast, how dark it is, how completely black dark it is. But then, depending on where you're at in whatever ocean you're in, the like pushing through the water, and you can be bumping up against certain kinds of aquatic life or living. Like seaweed kind of stuff, But it's phosphorus in the middle of the night when it's so dark out. And so you're passing through the ocean and you can look down and see just, it's strange. I mean, beautiful and strange. And so a lot of different types of things that I saw in the middle of the ocean growing up as a landlocked person, even though I grew up on a state that had a beach. I mean, there were people that I served in the military with who were coming out of the Midwest and had never in their lives seen the Pacific Ocean or the, you know, nothing, or or being stationed with. I remember it was pretty rare that it would snow in Norfolk, and having a coworker who was a Filipino had never seen snow before, and so being with him and watching him experience that was pretty cool.
Tell me a little bit more about the hazing. You mentioned it a few times.
Yeah, and I'm going to add to that is, what was the official view of the hazing?
Some things weren't that big of a deal. Like, you're about to go on a deployment, so everybody gets a, what they call a med cut or a med haircut. So you cut your hair really, really short with the idea that by the time you're done with your deployment and come home, your hair's growing out again. So that might not be that big of a deal. And then advancing in rank was completely open and accepted, that people of higher rank would tack your rank on you. And there were certain people in the military, in the Navy, who were what we called push button. These were people that were in certain jobs that were in such need that by the time they're done with their initial training and join the fleet, they're already an E4, or they're already a petty officer. And so people like me that worked up through E1 up to E4 or whatever, I just, like, they, just people like that weren't going to be putting their hands on me because they didn't earn it. and then the frustrating thing, I think, about the Navy at that time, which was, you know, peacetime, was advancement in the military was extremely slow. So I passed the exam and all that for E5 twice, and both times they just said, we have too many E5s in the Navy, so we're just going to keep those in E4. So the hazing thing was a wide range of things, like a BT punch, you know, telling somebody, go down in the engine room and go ask for so-and-so. So you're having some young person ask for a big, huge, brawny boiler technician, and you're going to request a tool from them. So you're looking for a BT punch, but really a BT punch is asking a BT to smack you. And so once they come back, you know, and they're rubbing their arm or something, and it's like, haha, you got me that time. Or the, on this sailor, the ship picture, the guy on the right, it was a corpsman. I used to hang out with him over in sick bay and get a knock on the door and open it up, and some young guy, you know, is coming in saying, well, my chief sent me over here to get 3 feet of fallopian tubing, you know, and not knowing what the hell that is, you know. And so then he's, you know, like, gets some rubber tubing and said, well, I can only spare, you know, about 12 inches, so here you go, and go ask your chief if this is what you're looking for. And so some of it was kind of not that big of a deal, or asking for the keys to somewhere where there's no such thing as key, like keys to the captain's gig, because on our ship you had life preservers, but you also had two boats that could get lowered into the water, and so you might send someone to look for some keys that don't exist, or you know, go look for 4 feet of chow line or something, which just has to do with stand in line for the cafeteria.
Or in the Air Force prop wash.
Yeah. So just, I think every branch has their.
What's your official
card?
Yeah, so that top picture up there, when I was a student here, I was still in the reserves. Mm-hmm. That was probably about a year before I went to the university. And then these pictures were reminding me, kind of almost like my own students now, where I was still wearing the stuff that I wore in the military. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was my firefighting, the bottom part of my jersey that I used to wear. When I was at the U of O, I stayed in touch with the guy who was a corpsman. He ended up staying in the Navy for a career. And so at one point I flew to Texas, and so I'm sitting there wearing some Oregon gear. checking in, stonewashed jeans back in the good old days. And then that was the day I graduated from the University of Oregon.
What was your major at UO?
Well, that's a great question, because when I first came to college, I really hated people, really hated what I had seen in humanity. And so I was a computer science major and, you know, was forced as an undergraduate to take all these other random courses. The burden of it all, you know. But then I'm taking Soc and Psych, and all of a sudden I'm getting really turned on by these things. And so by the time I transferred to the University of Oregon, I was a sociology major and ethnic studies minor. So I'm all of a sudden I'm being exposed to classes that are unlocking these narratives and really forcing me to reflect on some of these things. You know, at one point in 1985, as we were deploying to the Mediterranean, we were in Guatemala. In 1985, Guatemala was not a happy, happy, joy place, especially with all the horrible human rights shit that was going on. So I'm in a class where we're reading Rigoberta Menchu's book, and then I'm starting to do these calculations in my head about when was I there and why was I there, what were we doing, you know. And there's just certain things, I think, that once you're exposed to that knowledge, you can't close that box anymore. And so I was kind of disturbed by having allowed myself to be a part of something that that I'm now so against. So
what's your profession here at LCC?
I'm the head of the Ethnic Studies program. So I get to teach about all that stuff now.
Mm-hmm. And so did your military service affect how you teach? And obviously, like you said, Guatemala, while you were in Guatemala, kind of.
On my third deployment, we were, so now I'm, you know, starting to become a short timer. So we're out in the middle of the ocean, just making big squares out in the ocean, which was just a shitty way of us making fun of the fact that we were on patrol. We're out in the Eastern Mediterranean with another frigate, and this Iraqi jet fighter fires a couple of missiles and hits our sister ship. What was the name of that ship? Maybe the USS Stark. So 38 sailors are vaporized, just like that. At the time, we're friends with Saddam Hussein, because he's making Iran have a hard time. You know, so we're all looking around like, what the hell's going on? And then just classic, you know, military government stuff and trickle down. Of course, we don't know what's going on, and no one's going to tell us what's going on. So it's after lunch, and we're sitting around playing cards, and all of a sudden we get the call for battle stations. And as we've gone through training a million times over, if they come over the intercom system and say, this is a drill, and then hit the alarm, you know it's a drill. If you hear the alarm and you don't hear this is a drill, then it's the real deal, completely real deal. So all we hear is this battle station alarm. We're thinking incoming, because we've now pushed into, I think, I don't know what we call it, but we don't call it DEFCON, but it was like DEFCON, whatever, 3. So 4 would be going to war. 1 is usually what you're in when you're home port in Norfolk. So we're on a high state of alert or whatever. At that point, I no longer was a firefighter. So I'm heading up to the bridge for my duty station. And as I'm getting close to the bridge, then somebody comes over the intercom system and they're screaming, you know, belay this order. Something happened. No, you know, don't pay attention to what you just heard. And so I'm kind of launching myself up onto this staircase. And so now my brain's telling me to stop, which doesn't work when you're in midair. And So anyway, I ended up dislocating my shoulder. And so in my recovery, they need to fly me back to Norfolk to start my exit, everything, so I can get the hell out of there. And, you know, and I asked my students, well, you know, what do you think we did? How did we retaliate against Saddam Hussein? You know, and they're thinking in their own minds in reference to now. You know, and, oh, we do this and we do this. And we, you know, it was like, we did nothing because he was our friend. You know, so you start getting old enough to start seeing, you know, who's our friend now and who's not our friend and who's our buddy and who's not our buddy and what countries do we go to show off or whatever. And so I think all of those things, I'm assuming, you know, probably impacted me as a human being. So, yeah.
Do you have any more questions?
I mean, at the same time, shitty professors impact who I am. Yeah. You know, so throughout your academic career, and you're like, God, if I ever go in the classroom, I'm not going to do this or I'm not going to do that. Or
couple of just basic type of questions, again, from my own personal, not own personal, but just to give a little bit more information in regards to the daily life. So when you're on deployment, it's 7 days a week, but basically an 18 hours. It has to be, obviously, yeah,
24 hours a day. No. I mean, because that's what they tell you. Like, look, we own you.
Yes.
If we work you 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, we get to. Mm-hmm. You know, if after 18 hours we say, we're done with you for the day, you should be grateful to us. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, it's like, okay. You know, you got to adjust your way of thinking. So,
again, I was in the Army, and I was in a very different position. So mine was a 40-hour week, so I was very fortunate.
But on there were three of us that went in the military together. So first when I was going to go in the Air Force, I talked a buddy of mine into going into the Air Force. He was a plumber, and he lived off base. He'd get dressed, drive to work, do his thing, drive home. You know, this other friend of mine that was on a submarine, I think he made one very short deployment. The rest of his time, hanging out in Norfolk, you know, he'd go to work in the morning, he'd go back to his dorm thing in the afternoon, and that was really the essence of the military, I think, at that time. You just rolled the dice. I mean, on our ship, there was, you know, you'd be out in the middle of the ocean and you're doing underway replenishment. And so either of the ships is shooting this big, huge bullet looking thing to the other ship. And then you're pulling on a string, and then eventually you're pulling on a line, and eventually you're pulling over fuel lines or big, huge cargo net things full of mail or whatever. And we were next to this ship and they were feeling kind of bored, and so they decided to aim towards somebody. Well, they shot that big, huge thing, and it hit somebody square on in the face, you know, and just, you know, or it was like living in a factory. I mean, it's this massive industrial thing, so there's constantly these accidents or people getting their fingers crushed or running into the, you know, you're walking through portals, and so, yeah, it was kind of odd.
Okay, that brings up another point then in regards to the medical care. On that size of ship that you were on, medic or corpsman or whatever they call it, is that the highest you had, or did you?
Yeah.
And then,
yeah, no, I think if you were on like an aircraft carrier, they probably would have a doctor maybe. Okay. Or, yeah, I mean, we had a, but I would never discount what a corpsman can do, and especially eventually my friend became a IDC, an independent duty corpsman. So he went back to school. So our chief, E7, was an IDC. And that might be the equivalent, I don't know, of like an LPN not a doctor, but definitely something where they could perform some procedures. I mean, sick bay. It was a surgical sick bay. I mean, it had the big, huge lights and all that stuff. And I think on deployment, I mean, even when we were up in the Arctic Circle, you know, you're deploying as a full battle group. So at any given moment, even though we might not see them on the horizon, there would be an aircraft carrier and battleships and cruisers and submarines and, you know, pretty much an intact whatever.
Floating group of cities or blocks.
So,
yeah. So you had medical attention.
Yeah, like the guy who got shot in the face, I mean, they medevaced him to somewhere that could help him better than, you know, and then we had some big, huge steam explosion thing that somebody got severely burned, and so they took him away, and so, yeah.
Another, in regards to your not being aware of, not thinking that you were going to end up on a ship, did you get seasick?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I was a straight-up landlubber, and the first time we ever left port, thank God it was only for like 3 days. We went up to Yorktown. Yorktown was where you'd upload ammo, missiles, shells, small arms stuff. And yeah, we immediately deployed. And if you're E3 and below, you have to do 3 months in the kitchens working for supply. So I was working for them. Oh man, I was straight up green. I mean, it's true. You see people truly, truly seasick, and they change color. And I couldn't even function. So I ended up crawling into somebody else's rack, and that way they couldn't find me. And so then afterwards, you know, I mean, eventually you get your sea legs, but you know, I had to Dramamine and crackers and go topside and breathe some fresh air, all the normal
roughly
stuff.
Your rough guess as far as people on their first deployment at sea, percentage wise, that were having the similar thing with that you were.
Oh my God. I was just thinking of this close friend of mine from New York who used to walk around. He had a hefty bag tied to his belt loop, you know, because you're so sick. So everywhere on the ship, people are thrown up and whatever, and they're not well enough to clean up after themselves, you know, so no, 10-15% or something. Okay. And I mean, if you were like some chronic, uber chronic, you know, you just never ever could get your sea legs, then they'd probably send you somewhere more humane. But I mean, for most of us, you get your sea legs, and truly, you know, you hit the beach overseas, and you're kind of wobbling around when you first get off the ship. You know, it's all that stuff's all true. So yeah.
Yeah. No, is there anything that you would like to add that you may have missed?
You know, I hadn't thought about the UFO in a long time. So I was digging around for stuff, and the first Gulf War was when I was at the University of Oregon. And that was kind of you know, I had friends that were still in, and I had friends here that were thrown back into the military, and you start, I guess, being confronted with choices of, you know, whether you're going to support something or be against something, and so yeah, I ended up marching against the first Gulf War, and which kind of alienated me with some of my close friends that were still in the military. So even though by the time I was at the University of Oregon, I was no longer on educational benefits and was probably on some other life path or whatever, but still had these ties and these relationships and full-blown PTSD, untreated at the time. It wasn't until I went to graduate school that I actually went to a vet center and started getting some help. So,
what about your friend? Where is he?
Which one? We just talked on the phone. Got out after probably 23 years or something, and then went to college, and works in the medical field. He's originally from Texas and had been in California for a long time, and so just now back in Texas and all happy to be back in that gross state. And, his kids are, yeah, I mean, they're full-on grown men and women kind of thing, you know, so his daughter, who's a, you know, grown woman, was my goddaughter, and his son is now in the Air Force overseas, and then my buddy, who was on the submarine, lives here in Springfield, and works for Northwest Natural Gas, and I was actually thinking about calling him this weekend just to check in. So,
well, thank you very much.
Hey.